This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Korerotia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Welcome to Speak Up Korerotia. My name is Sally Carlton, based here in Christchurch. Today we're going to be talking about what motivates people to make a difference. This is a pretty massive question, and I'm really looking forward to getting into it. It turns out that this show's airing just a few days before World Humanitarian Day, which is a reminder on the need to act to alleviate the suffering of people around the world. It's also a bit of a recognition of the importance of volunteers and volunteering. So it was quite timely in that this show's airing about now. I'd like to introduce our guests. We've got Billy Osteen from the University of Canterbury, Sarah Campagnolo, who has many hats, including at the moment Gap Filler, Jason Pemberton, you also have a number of hats. You can tell us about them later, and Toyota Jardine. Now, to give us a little bit more insight into why you're taking part, it would be fantastic to hear from you a little bit about your background and what it is you're going to be bringing to the conversation. Billy, how about we start with you?
Great, thanks very much. So, as Sally said, I teach at the University of Canterbury, and my main position is I'm the Director of Community Engagement. And that position, I largely have Jason Pemberton to thank because it is a follow-on to the fantastic work that the Student Volunteer Army did back in 2011. And this idea about making a difference is particularly of interest to me because our university states as its mission that we are preparing people to make a difference. And that mission statement was created before the earthquakes, and I would argue that it had very little relevance or meaning to most of us who work there. And then the earthquakes and the Student Volunteer Army gave us a lot more purchase with that kind of statement and vision statement. So I've been doing some research over the past 6 months into this notion about making a difference and can share a bit about that later on.
Looking forward to it.
Kia ora, Sally. Chorty Jardine's my name. I whakapapa through my mother's side of the whānau to Waitaha, Kachi Māmui, Kaitahu whānau and iwi. And I sit on the conservation board as an iwi representative, and I'm involved with the Even or Takaro Network and also with the volunteer in Canterbury. And a lot of the things that I've done in my life have been volunteering, although I've never actually thought of them as being volunteering. So I'm kind of interested in how people do their work and sometimes not even know that they're actually being a volunteer. They just come along and get stuck in.
Yeah. I think that's a very, very critical point, actually, and I'm sure we'll be thinking about that more. Yeah.
Kia ora, I'm Sarah Campagnolo. I'm currently the chair of Volunteering Canterbury and the volunteer coordinator at Gapfiller. Previously, I was running Greening the Rubble as well. I've also been involved with all sorts of activism and volunteering since I left high school, basically. And really interested in the term making a difference. A lot of what I've come across in all sorts of walks of life is how many people want to make a difference. And I guess I'm really interested in why people do, and also the volunteering perspective, and that people don't often acknowledge what they're doing is volunteering, and I've had to convince people before that they are a volunteer. And, you know, the common definition of it. So, that's my background.
Fantastic. Thanks, Sarah.
Nice. Kia ora. I'm Jason Pemberton. So Sarah and I used to work together, and Billy was on our board and done a lot of volunteer initiatives with Tilti, so it's kind of nice to be all together again. So, like Billy said, I was involved with the Student Volunteer Army when it founded, and stayed around there for about 3 years, and then popped out the other side and was really interested in that notion of making a difference and how we can put something a bit more important than money in front of us at all times. So I've been on a bit of a journey looking at how we can make the best use of ourselves in a way that supports other people to make the best use of themselves. So I'm really interested in things like organizational design and governance and instruments and frameworks for articulating our intent and all of those sorts of nerdy terms. So, yeah, I think this is a really cool topic to be chewing on and some really cool people to be doing it with. So glad to be here.
Excellent. Well, I guess my first question to you is, what do we mean if we say making a difference? Is it volunteering? Is it activism? Sarah, you touched on that term as well. Any thoughts that might help us sort of get into the conversation?
I think my first sense of trying to make a difference was years ago when I was traveling, living in Montreal, and became involved with the peace movement. And that was the first time that I felt like I needed to sort of step outside of my normal life frame and participate in something that I felt really strongly about. So from there, I think that was, I mean, that was my first taste of feeling as if I can make a difference. And whether we did or not isn't, I don't know if you can measure what happened in all of those things that we were involved with. But I'll tell you, it felt good to be feeling as if I might make a difference. Yeah. I think that's the thing.
Yeah. What led you to do that? What were the key sort of moments in your life that when you had sort of this moment of truth of responding, you decided to do something?
This was the atmosphere of the city at the time. Montreal in the 60s, taking in draft resistance people from the States, working through the McGill University, who was setting up the whole peace program. And also, from years ago, my great uncle telling me about landing at Gallipoli, and I swore there and then I'd never pick up a gun for anyone. So that morning when he told me that story, I became a pacifist. And so here was I in a situation where just down in the States, people were being, young men were being drafted and sent off to this ridiculous war that they'd got themselves involved with. So it did come as a natural sort of evolvement of where I was sitting, and suddenly here was an opportunity to be able to do something. So,
because in the folks that I've been interviewing who have made a difference, I've come up with a framework of three components essentially, and you've just described them really well. So one is that there is some sense of preparation,
right?
So that you are capable of taking the opportunity when it comes to do something about it.
Okay.
So there's preparation.
Right.
So it sounds like you were prepared.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity that you are ready to step into and engage with. But then the most important piece is the third piece that people have told me sort of across different fields and different sectors, and it's a notion of purpose.
Yeah.
So what you've just described about your uncle, that gave you the purpose that then put you in a position to do something about it.
Yeah,
that's a really cool thing to parallel. A lot of the work I'm doing at the moment is in the social enterprise world. We've got the Social Enterprise World Forum coming here, and we talk about the difference between an organization's footprints and an organization's handprints. So everyone's familiar with the term footprints, and I think that you can essentially draw a line between footprints and handprints and say, well, that's the corporate social responsibility movement, and this is the purpose-led movement. And I think that's the that's a really interesting sort of parallel there.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's very easy and should be the norm for us to be minimizing our footprints, and a lot of people are about that. But what we're seeing now is a whole wave of people trying to maximize their handprints.
Mm. Right.
Mm. Yeah. I'm part of a kind of movement, and I'm really interested in statistics. It's like my dad's a math teacher and I'm a math person. So I'm really interested in like effective altruism and what actually works, because so many people, and it's come across, like, you know, I've worked in a lot of corporate backgrounds who, and they're like, I want to make a difference. But to me, they're like driving big, massive cars. They're doing all this sort of stuff. They don't volunteer. And I'm like, what makes you think you're making a difference, and how can you measure that? And that's what I'm really interested in. How can I measure what difference I'm making, what impact I have? And I think that's really, for me, that's what motivates me and a lot of the decisions I make, is that there are so many options to do, but what actually works and what's actually working.
We've found some lessons in ancient texts, if you will. And so one piece that we use with students who are doing community engagement work, which is different than volunteering, So community engagement or service learning is volunteering as an activity, but then it's placed within the context of critique and critical thinking within a university setting. And one of the best pieces that we found in terms of here are all these options, how do I evaluate what to do, comes from the Torah, so the ancient Jewish text. Yeah. And the Torah has a section in it where it's super specific about here are 8 ways that you could help somebody, and here's how they're ranked from 1 to 8. And it's fascinating because when you push people into ranking, you know, isn't all helping good helping? Isn't all volunteering good helping? No, it's not. You know, and this is saying, if you've got these 8 options in front of you, here's what you should do first off, second, third, fourth, fifth. So it's a different kind of notion about evaluating than what we're used to doing with adding up hours or, you know, economic impact or various other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think rabbit-proof fence to me is one of the biggest things. If you look at that guy that's considered the evil character, he's making a difference, and that's his intention, is to make their lives better, but he's doing horrible things. And so I always have that in the back of my head.
Exactly.
I'm trying to think, am I making a difference, or am I just, you know, making myself feel good by trying to do something?
And it's interesting putting that value statement on it, because that's one of the challenges that we've had with this as our mission statement at Canterbury. People prepared to make a difference. Well, we're not saying what kind of difference they're prepared to make. We could be preparing people to be sort of the next tyrant or evil person, and they'll still be prepared to make a difference. So how do we attach value to that, and whose value?
Yeah.
You know?
And also, just because we're prepared doesn't mean they're necessarily going to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So it seems like, oh, there's no argument with a phrase like that. But yet, once you unpack it a little bit, it actually can be quite problematic.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
So many questions. Okay, well, we might have the first song. Billy, you chose for us Kenny Chesney's This Is Our Moment. Was there a reason for that? A
couple of reasons. So Kenny Chesney is, last year he was the second highest gross profit in terms of touring in the United States, country music star. He is from my hometown, and he and I are very short in stature, and we played football against each other, actually, in high school. But knowing how our size was then and is now, we actually didn't really, you know, we were probably on the sidelines looking at each other. But anyway, and this song in particular is about, it's his reflection, I think, about what it feels like to perform in front of 80,000 people. So saying, this is our moment. But for me, it's, what is your moment as in a moment of truth? So when you're faced with something, and I'll use Jason and his buddies as an example, you know, they were faced with the question about what they were going to do with their time when classes were canceled. And they chose to spend their time going out to Hallswell and to Bromley and to Bexley and various places. So it's, what do you decide to do when all the stuff is in front of you in terms of a moment?
Great. Well, thank you for the choice.
We've been sweating a whole lot long just to get this right. It's a work hard hit, hard struggle, it's a sacrifice. It's time to blow it up, time to lock and load, time to take the field, time to start the show. This is our moment, this is our time. This is our moment. is our moment. This is our time. And we ain't holding back. We're laying it on the line. This is our destiny. It's our night to shine. This is our.
We're talking about making a difference, and in this section I'm particularly keen to focus on how do we measure it. We've touched on the Torah and those eight suggestions. We've touched on, Sarah, what you were talking about with how do you even begin to talk about it as a positive thing. You can potentially make a difference in a negative way, those sorts of big issues. And Jason, I know you're really interested in measurements as well, so I'm sure we've got lots to say in this segment. So I'll open it up with how can we measure making a difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the from a volunteering perspective, there's the real basic things like how many hours, tasks achieved, things like that. So, and there's volunteering New Zealand have just started making sure that they do those sorts of measurements every year, and also talking to the charities themselves about what volunteers do for them. They don't show the whole picture, obviously, and they can talk about, we can talk about hours, and volunteering can, we've just talked about how much money, if we paid all our volunteers minimum wage, how much money would that contribute to the economy, and things like that. So it's all very useful, but for me it's like, does it make a difference? What is the end goal, and who does it affect, and how much does that matter? If we affect one person, is that enough? And things like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really fascinating thing to think about relative to purpose or intent, because if you take, this will be like an obscure metaphor, but if you think about something like throwing a rock into a pond, you say, well, what was the impact of that? It's like, well, you could say it's the displacement of the water, you know, how much the water is lifted, or how many waves were created, or how far the waves went out, or how tall the waves were, or how high the water splashed when the rock hit. Or it's kind of like you can measure just about anything, but it really depends on what you're trying to achieve and what's important to you. And I think that's a really interesting thing that a lot of people don't think about before they're trying to make a difference, in inverted commas. It's what are you actually trying to achieve, and how, you know, what's the measure of success? I'm glad to hear you mention the effective altruism movement. I think that's a really interesting space. I actually just applied for a fellowship, an effective altruism fellowship, like 3 days ago. So. I think social enterprise is really tossing some of this stuff up into the air in New Zealand, because you look at the something like the Sustainable Development Goals, or any of the global frameworks, the UN frameworks that New Zealand has signed up for, and you could argue that any one of those are about making a difference at a big level. And then you look at, say, the Charities Act in New Zealand, and if you're going to get charitable status in New Zealand, you've got to line up with one of the four benefits in the Charities Act. And there's a whole lot of other stuff that sits in these global frameworks that doesn't sit in those four benefits. And so it's really interesting to think about that. Well, what do we mean in New Zealand by make a difference? By the letter of the law, it's quite specific. But at a personal level, I think we'd all point to things a bit bigger than just the list of four benefits.
Yeah, and they're based on, I think, England's Charity Act that came around in, like, you know, I don't know,
1840 or something.
And it's still the same. Those same four purposes. So it's very, we live in a very different society from when those four were created as well, which I think is quite interesting.
Totally. So I think it's going to be interesting to see where and how those sorts of things evolve. And when we know that there are new ways that you can organise yourself, and we know that a lot of the challenges that we're facing don't respect national boundaries, so why should the solutions have to respect national boundaries? I think those are the sorts of things that we're going to start having to chew on as a society. And New Zealand really could be a leader in that space, I think.
And I think you're raising a couple of points there, one of which is around the notion of knowing what kind of difference you're trying to make or trying to impact or achieve. And then in some ways that should backward design you back to the point at which somebody decides to volunteer. Because in a sense, and you know, I can draw on the Torah again, but then other, various other things. In a sense, we're not just wanting people to just go volunteer or just make a difference. We actually probably want to qualify that difference into positive or impactful or something like that. And in order to do that, that requires a bit more training and preparation and a different outlook than just simply saying, all comers, sign up, we'll go volunteer, we'll go paint this fence, or we'll go dig a garden, or we'll do whatever. So if you really want there to be a difference to be made, you have to know what that is and then build that into your process earlier on.
Mm. And struggled a lot with it, but was always told it's just the way it is. There's nothing you can do. And so when I started volunteering, it's like, well, actually, you know, my first volunteering was at Trade Aid doing fair trade, and there's a measurable impact on communities that have a fair trade system in place.
Yep.
And so for me, volunteering is that first step of being like, you actually can make a difference, rather than it's kind of the first step and the idea that they can make a difference, and then they need to think about what they want to do.
How they do it.
Stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be a good time to go back to the point you raised, Teotihu, which is how do people even recognize if they're volunteering? And if they're not necessarily recognizing that they are volunteering or making a difference, does that still count in inverted commas?
Mm.
I'm thinking about some of the things that I've done that I wouldn't consider being volunteering, but there was a purpose that drew this particular group of people together, and then we were committed to the purpose. And I'm not sure, though, how we measure, did that make a difference? I mean, there is some outcome sometimes, and you think, well, that was a lot of effort, and we did do something, or did that just bounce off something? And going back to the 60s, I had friends who were pacifists who were so consumed by what it was they were opposing that that ate them up.
Yeah.
They were learning to make bombs. I mean, they moved from being a pacifist to becoming exactly what they were opposing. And to me, that was a real warning. We've got to be careful about this. If that so-called enemy is such a focus that we become like it, then we've fallen into the trap of behaving exactly the way, and that was became quite obvious later in the 60s, that we were behaving the way the establishment wanted us to behave. So then they could point the finger and say, look at this. Mm-hmm. So a lot of learning went on during those particular times. But I'm not sure about how do we measure what a difference is, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm with a group at the moment, and basically we are setting up a partnership with the city council to ensure that biodiversity runs through everything that they do, not just because it's parks or recreation, but it's everything. Whatever is happening, whatever the council is involved with, they've got biodiversity in their face at some level. So I suppose if that happens, then we can feel like, yes, we did make a difference.
Yep. Yep.
But I think it's kind of interesting thing, because we also need to talk about what difference has it made to me.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to me when I was involved in this? So I think that's worth thinking about. What is it that the individual brings to a situation, and how has that changed? Or, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
I
think there's measuring differences on many levels rather than, is it just the outcome? What happened to me when I was doing this? All of those things need to be weighed up, don't they, if you're going to look at measuring what was the difference that happened.
Because you can look at it in a very clinical, quantitative way and say X number of people devoted this number of hours to this cause. It would have cost this much money, blah, blah, blah. But what you're describing is much harder to capture both in the moment, because a lot of these experiences that we might have in being volunteers or being activists or whatever, the actual payoff and the transformation for us may come way further down the road.
Right.
And so we have to acknowledge that there are benefits or side products, byproducts of these engagements that we may not be able to get a hold of.
And you've just reminded me a lot of, for in Te Ao Māori, we just do things. I mean, if there's a tangi, we turn up at the marae, we feed everyone. And when we're looking out from the kitchen and everyone's sitting down having a great feed, we go, yes, we've done it. I mean, there's that simple kind of, yes, we have made a difference. We've fed all these people.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's also one of my questions, I guess, is I don't imagine that people see that as volunteering or necessarily even making a difference. It's just something that is done.
We call manaakitaka, taken care of, and we just do that. And no one would even imagine to think of themselves as being a volunteer.
That's right.
It's there's a need. We're filling the need and we're going for it.
Yeah. And I looked into cultural differences with regard to volunteering in New Zealand and found that there was no directly translatable word for volunteer into Maori. And it's because exactly what you've just described, they don't really view it that way because it's just how you carry on. It's how you do things.
Yeah.
And in the stats of volunteers in New Zealand, I think 90% of people who identify as having Maori heritage volunteer, quote unquote. And most of that is done with the marae, the local iwi, et cetera. But it's not viewed as volunteering.
No, and on the statistics, we saw statistics at Volunteering Canterbury. And there's a little box like about this little, I mean, compared to the other ethnicities who volunteer. Maori, it looked like, when you look at that, you think, oh, Maori don't volunteer. Because we're busy doing it.
Too busy doing it to talk about it.
Yeah.
I think volunteering as a term and as a concept is quite a Western thing, and I think it is partly because there's that break between we have our own individual family units or individual units versus a lot of other cultures and societies, even when they've modernized, quote unquote, are still very community and extended family based and things like that, and so they support their family that way, where we have segmented everything. We are hospitals, everything like that is separate. Yeah. So we need volunteers to keep going. But I think in a lot of other cultures and countries, there's not quite that need.
That's right.
That's just done as part of community life.
And it was interesting when we were setting up this course right after the 2011 earthquakes, and the motivation to set up the course was to give the Student Volunteer Army members a place to reflect on their service and to do it within an academic setting. And we consulted with these guys a lot on how would a course like this look, what's legitimate to you. You know, we don't want to co-opt what you've done. We want to celebrate it. And we initially had a bit of pushback from Jason and his colleagues because they didn't want it to appear that they had volunteered to get course credit.
Yeah.
And they were keeping things a bit more in a box. You know, that's what we did over there. We didn't intend to do that as students of a university. We did that just as concerned
as humans.
Citizens. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. So there was a resistance to merge the two things of academia and volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that the community engagement or a service learning movement is really valuable. But when you're making students volunteer because they have to get so many hours for whatever, you know, the intent gets a bit lost.
It defeats the purpose. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like it defeats the purpose. But I haven't figured out how, I mean, sure, you haven't figured out how to reconcile that.
No.
You know?
Well, I'm kind of the, like, volunteering, and we've done some stuff about Chiwetea's laughing because we were very strict, and then we did the session, our session. By the end of it, we're like, it's all volunteering, everything.
Yeah.
It's all okay. But I don't know, there's a few things, studies came out of the States in the 70s, I think. My memory's a bit vague, but about people who were kind of forced to volunteer as part of course credit, and they ended up being lifelong volunteers and having a lot more incidents of activism, making a difference, thinking about what their impact is, than people who weren't forced to volunteer at university.
Yeah.
And so while the intent kind of can be a bit messy, I think sometimes the impact is the same long term.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Interesting. Okay, well, it's time for our next song. TOT have chosen for us Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now.
That came to me when I read your email properly and thought, oh, there's an opportunity. And that song just came to me. And it's all about that life's illusions. What is that line? Life's illusions. I don't know life at all,
Yeah.
basically. I know the illusion of it. And to me, that's where we sit in ourselves. I mean, that's how I sit in the world. And I've studied esoteric things. I've been part of a school that I'm going to advertise now, the Bishara School of Intensive Esoteric Education, where we were reading this 13th century mystic's work, who just began with, "There is only God." So then we're going, how the hell do we fit into this, you know? What is this? But it was really statements about the unity of all existence. And those same statements that my tūpuna, that was their work too. That's how what they knew. And I feel like I get a taste of that, but most of what I see in the world is the illusion of the world. The essence is kind of hidden, and that's the mystery. I think that's the thing that as human beings, we're asked to explore. So to me, that's always a kind of tantalizing place. And I think Joni gathers that up with this song. That was wafting on a bit more than I intended to.
I like it. Awesome.
Rows and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds. Moons and Junes and Ferris wheels, the dizzy dancing way that you feel, as every fairy tale comes through. I've looked at love that way, but now it's just another show. And you leave them laughing when you go. And if you can, don't let them know. Don't give yourself away. I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take. Still somehow it's love's illusions that I recall. I really don't know love. I really don't know love at all. And feeling proud to say I love you right out loud. Dreams and schemes and circus crowds, I've looked at life that way. Oh, but now, old friends, they're acting strange, and they shake their heads and they tell me that I've changed. Well, something's lost, but something's gained in living every day. I look at life illusions I recall. I really don't know life at all. Life's illusions that I recall. I really don't know life. I really don't know life at all.
You're listening to Speak Up Korero here, here on Plains FM 96.9. We're talking about making a difference today. And we've touched on it already, but we're going to think more about who makes a difference. We've talked a little bit about cultural differences. And then I think we'll finish up with how do we encourage people to get on board with this. So just to start the conversation flowing again, we've talked about statistics and various statistics being captured. Teoti mentioned that in terms of the statistics, it doesn't look like Māori volunteer much at all. Do we get a sense from the statistics, other than just ethnicity, also, say, gender, age differences, those sorts of things, who volunteers, who makes a difference?
Yeah, well, in regards to volunteering, I know sport is a big one that especially, like, dads and guys do, but they don't see it as volunteering. And I think that's often can reflect in the statistics where you've got lower male volunteers, but I know that we often get requests to, like, how can we get more male volunteers, especially in kind of mentoring roles and things like that. So I think males do volunteer, but in different forms, like more in sport and things like that. But again, how that volunteering reflects making a difference, I don't know, but I can talk the statistics around that and the experiences we have.
I think one area that I've been surprised with regard to volunteer turnout has been with school boards of trustees. So in the last cycle, and the way school boards of trustees work is that parents in the resident community put their hand up, nominate themselves, somebody nominates them, and then there is an election, and the terms are 3 years. And in the last election cycle, less than half of schools in New Zealand had elections. And that is because either the same number of people as spaces available ran, or fewer people ran than spaces. And it breaks down in terms of school deciles. Mm-hmm. So deciles 6 through 10 tend to have elections. Deciles 1 to 5 tend to just have whoever put their hand up, they get a spot. And for me, that's a really interesting problem to try to resolve, because that is democracy at its most local level. Mm. And you would think at its most impactful level. You know, you're talking about people's kids and what they presumably would be concerned about. So for me, that particular segment with regard to volunteering is one that I'd like to figure out how to get more people to put their hand up, to come show up to be a Board of Trustee member.
Yeah, I wonder if it's partly around empowerment and, you know,
yep,
people valuing their voice, or feeling like if they did turn up that it would actually be worthwhile.
And feeling like they may not have the skills,
yeah,
to do it, you know, when in fact you need basic, you know, meeting sort of skills. You know, how do you work well with other people? How do you present your ideas? How do you listen? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, but also I think working parents, it's much harder, you know,
yep,
to come that with volunteering. By the time you have children, have a job, and a lot of families need 2 full-time incomes to make it work these,
yep,
days, like,
yeah,
you know, do,
yeah,
they,
yeah,
have time for a board and,
yeah,
things like that as well.
Yeah. And I think to me that speaks of the importance of preparing people and training them almost to be good volunteers.
Yeah.
Because of the over-reliance, I think, of New Zealand on essential services to be staffed by volunteers. So
yeah,
the fire brigade, surf life saving, school boards of trustees, the jury system. And in some ways we've got a key competency in the curriculum for participating and contributing, but it's not measured in many places. Mm-hmm. Numeracy and literacy is measured. This other notion about being a contributing member of society is not measured as much.
No. And
or if at all.
Yeah. Or it's just some schools like tick off the hours, but like you say, you don't
That's
know.
Right.
If the teacher doesn't know what they're doing and just like, okay, let's go pick up some rubbish, which is very important, but don't know how much reflection they've had and how much they understand.
That's
they
right.
know what they're doing, what impact, and all that sort of stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, if it's not sort of fostering a moral imperative.
Yep.
What's the real value?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Does it make a difference if... make a difference? Okay. That might be the wrong terminology in this context, but does it make a difference? We all know the earthquakes, for example, were such a key motivating, driving factor. Does it make a difference having that sort of event or moment? Billy, this might work in your framework that you kind of
absolutely.
Touched on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It absolutely does. I mean, post 2012, Jason worked quite hard on this. We at the Student Volunteer Army Foundation had a passion and a purpose and a motivation to try to get Student Volunteer Army clubs set up at other universities around the country. And we utterly failed at getting any of them to take hold. And we came to the conclusion that no matter how good an example these guys set and how we could create manuals and ways to do it, if you didn't have a precipitating event, it wasn't going to happen. And that's an interesting, again, an interesting challenge. And the American philosopher William James posed that problem around the moral equivalent of war. So how do we get people as fired up, as passionate, as innovative, as, you know, full of comradeship and sort of wanting to go defeat something and make it so that it's not a war? And he came up with the answer that there is no moral equivalent of war. It achieves certain things that we have trouble doing in peacetime.
And that's a really, I've never heard about that before, but that's a really interesting thing to think about, because my mind immediately jumps to, well, it's the sense of urgency and the awareness of the problem.
Absolutely.
And we know that, let's just say, current populations are a lot more aware of the world's problems than previous populations. You know, we're way more connected, all those sorts of things. And the result is that we've got higher mental health decline, you know, there's like a whole bunch of negative stats on all of us. And I think that's maybe that we've got the huge compelling problems, but we don't have the sense of urgency that's presented.
They're not
by
in our face.
Like, exactly.
Yeah, they're not on our doorstep.
Yeah, and in a sense, they kind of are. You know, you go out to South Brighton and let's talk about sea level change.
Yeah, exactly.
Sea level rise. Like it's kind of it's right there, but it's not tangible and it doesn't have the same urgency that a war or an earthquake does.
I think also there's a time factor there. Like the students, you know, they had their classes cancelled.
Exactly. I
was in Auckland, but my partner, he had one day off for the earthquake. He didn't have power or water for weeks. Months, I think, and I moved in with him. We didn't have sewage for 9 months, you know. But we had to go to work every day and things like that. So,
Time is huge.
You know, time is huge, and part of that is that actually some people it's keeping the economy going and working and raising children and stuff like that. I think when you've got everyday things, they can easily get on top of you, and when you have spare time, you're just like, One thing I found interesting is when we're looking at volunteering stats, it's like we're not competing against other volunteer organizations to get volunteers. Generally, we're competing against leisure time.
Mm.
And so how do we make volunteering leisure time, which I think a lot of people have kind of worked on, and Volunteer Army definitely did some stuff around that when I was there. But it's the idea of leisure time versus volunteering and how can we kind of combine them more in, you know, everyday life as well.
Mm-hmm.
You've touched on getting people into volunteering. Have you seen that recruitment drives or publicity drives like Volunteer Week? We just talked about World Humanitarian Day. Those sorts of events that can acknowledge what people are doing. Does that make a difference at all in terms of encouraging people to get into it?
I don't know. I haven't seen any stats on that. I do know that from the VNZ State of Volunteering in New Zealand, thing that they put out, they kind of said that recruitment was a problem for, I think, around 70% of organisations. but retainment wasn't. It was 80% of people have no problems retaining volunteers, it's recruiting them. So I think to me it's like that first step of how can you get a volunteer on the track, and then once you've got them, it's not that hard to keep them.
Yeah, it's a powerful drug, really.
That's sort of back to your forced volunteering results, you know. So once you get somebody, then it's more likely that they're going to stick around and do this, but it's a matter of getting them.
Yeah.
And we've had success. We had success with the concert, with getting several thousand people volunteering who otherwise wouldn't have done it. We've had success with Serve for NZ, again, getting several thousand people to volunteer when they otherwise wouldn't. But those are one-offs.
Yeah.
You know, and we never really had follow-ups after either of those.
And I wonder how many times someone has to volunteer before they're kind of addicted.
It's a really good question. Yeah, that's a really good question.
I really like drawing on the vocabulary thing. You have to come across a word 7 times before it enters your vocabulary.
Yeah, right.
And I wonder how that principle sort of applies to other things.
That's a really good question.
Yeah,
it would be interesting to know, like, if we could force people to volunteer, trick them, bribe them, whatever we need to do. How many times do we need to do it before they're like, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this on my own volition?
Sort of thing.
And at Volunteer in Canterbury, we have talked about the image of volunteering. So that needs to change somehow because you have to be retired, or didn't have a good image, did it?
No.
So we need to explore how we can sell that, actually.
Yeah.
How we can sell that.
That comes back to that demographic again, I think. Who is it who has the time? Who can afford almost the time to volunteer? And often people think about being retired or middle class.
Yeah.
Class is another one.
Definitely, I think. And also, like, how can people do it from home? You know, I'm part of a lot of parenting Facebook groups, which I think a lot of people who run those wouldn't consider themselves volunteers, but they offer huge amounts of support and information and stuff like that. And they're mostly mothers, stay-at-home moms who run them. And I run one as well. But it's quite interesting. I haven't seen any research or studies on the impact of Facebook groups and Facebook support groups and things like that, and volunteering. And if once they go back to work or things like that, how much it impacts their choices or their choice to volunteer afterwards, or if they move into other forms of community building, I guess is probably the term.
Deloitte has a program called micro-volunteering.
Mm.
And so employees at Deloitte are given a certain amount of time per day off. Right. Like, and it's like 20 minutes or 50 minutes or whatever it is to devote to this. And they then remotely contribute to somebody's strategic plan, somebody's consulting plan, somebody's accounting, whatever it might be. But they do it in little chunks of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may never come face-to-face with the group or the person they're benefiting, but they're able to do it sort of on their own time in these little sort of micro chunks, which is a pretty cool way, kind of what you're describing, you know?
Yeah.
How to volunteer without being somewhere.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, really important part of how we need to kind of change our society a little bit, or change how we volunteer and change how we can get organisations to work in with that. And that's part of what I'm doing at GetFuller, is creating systems to kind of help those volunteers so that, because a lot of the time staff who manage volunteers or work in an organisation that use them, they don't have the time to kind of actually engage with the way volunteers need to. And again, going back to the stats, it was something like only 30% of volunteers actually reduce the cost of running the business for the volunteers. Like, so most of the time when you're volunteering,
you're costing.
Costing the organisation. But, you know, you're making a difference, you're helping the organisation. It's definitely part of the organisational goals. It's just it's not necessarily a time-saving thing. So how can we set up some systems that small charities especially can just log into, and they don't have to develop a whole new set of skills just to do some part. They can actually hook into something else, like the Deloitte thing, and get some skills, get some volunteers helping them, but not have to, you know, they'd have to invest more time and money to train than they'd probably get out of it. In the short term, anyway.
Yeah.
Because we're pretty much talking about the changing nature of work.
Yeah. Yeah, work in general. That's true.
You know, like, we've got a friend, Huya, who's an excellent, excellent connector. And so many amazing things have happened because she's met someone and said, oh, you need to talk to Billy, or you need to talk to Sarah. And they've gone off and done great things together. And we've spoken at length about that. She's like, well, that's kind of what I do. There's no way to monetize it or anything like that. It's a hugely valuable thing.
Right.
But it's just a different sort of work that she does, which she currently does voluntarily, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm really interested, this is a very separate conversation, but we look at things like the emergence of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and micro contracts and, you know, Ethereum, some of those sorts of things, and how they can enable us to do micro tasks and account for them in some way or another.
Mm. Yeah.
And that doesn't feel like volunteering or making a difference, but it absolutely is, you know, might take a tiny, tiny little introduction to fundamentally turn something into this amazing.
Yeah, and I guess if we're measuring making a difference rather than volunteering, those sorts of tasks like what Huya does, probably wouldn't measure it as volunteering, but in regards to making a difference, yeah, she's having huge impact.
Huge amounts, yeah. And it might only be maximum of 20 minutes a day or a week.
Knowing people, like having that kind of in your brain to be like, you need to talk to each other.
Yeah, seeing the web of things.
Yeah.
It's like I really like thinking about the difference between mints and chili con carne. It's just a tiny little bit of chili.
Right.
You know, if you didn't have the chili, it would just be a fundamentally different thing. But you add the chili and it's...
Yeah, it's a fancy meal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One question that might be good to ponder just as we're finishing up is, how do we, as people interested in discussing this issue, suggest that people decide where to devote their energies if they've got limited time, if they've got limited resources? What advice can we give in terms of effectively maximizing that time and making the choice about where they want to put their resources?
Kia ora. I'd like to say that it needs to come from a place where that person has an interest.
Yeah.
If there's an interest there, then there's no problem. Rather than taking on something as an obligation, that's not a place to go, even though that can be volunteering. But I think work on that interest, follow whatever it might be, and just follow that up, and there'll be people who'll connect you and who will connect with you, and before you know it, you'll be doing something and you'll actually be volunteering, but you won't even know it.
Yeah.
I think.
That would be my advice. Start somewhere, what you're interested in, and then start looking at the impacts it has as you go. But start first and then look. And it might be that actually what you do, you realize, doesn't have the impact you want it to do, but you're going to learn a skill, so you're going to get experiences there and you're going to get that positive feedback that will help you move on to your next thing. And so I'd say start, just do something, whether it's micro-volunteering, volunteering, or changing a lifestyle habit that has an impact, whatever is important to you, and then start looking at the stats and the research and things like that, and then kind of go from there. But don't wait until you have the answer, because you'll be like on your deathbed before you do, probably.
Yeah. And I think this kind of work affords you the opportunity to pursue your passion if your regular day job doesn't, you know?
Right.
So it could give you a real kind of, to branch off both what both of you guys have said, it's really the place to pursue your passion.
Yeah.
Mm.
And there are far more ways to pursue your passion in a volunteering sphere or making a difference than there are probably with jobs, paying jobs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of gives you an opportunity to sort of do good while you're doing well in your other position, your other job.
Yeah.
Any final key learnings, words of advice, concluding remarks? I also wondered, Tioti, if there's a whakatauki that sort of ties in these sorts of ideas we've been talking about.
There's one for Kaitahu, which is aroha ki ka takata. I mean, that is just... And often aroha is translated as love, but it's more than that. It's around manaaki, taking care of, and basically that's one of our tribal sayings, is take care of everyone. And if we're doing that, we do that in many ways, and I think that's my final sentence.
Good. But, yeah, I like that.
Aroha, kika, takata. Right.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I really like what you've just said, Tioti, and I think it's important to extend that to oneself as well.
Right.
There are a lot of people trying to do good or make a difference at their own expense, which is just hugely counterproductive.
Yeah.
So, you know, do less.
Yeah, right.
Would probably be my my thing.
I think you need to take your own advice.
Exactly.
Correctly. Do as I say, not as I do. But you know, like there are a lot of people like, oh, I'm just going to go to do some good over here, and overextending, and it's actually causes more harm in the long run than good.
And impact, you know, if you're spreading yourself too thin, you're not impacting anything.
Totally.
You know, I'm a, very big believer that I spread myself too thin. I'm always like looking at something new, and then but actually if you spend some time doing something, you're going to make a bigger difference than if you try and do everything a tiny bit.
Okay, well, I'd like to say thank you very much for coming in and discussing what is a massive topic. I'm sure we could have kept on chatting for ages, but hopefully this will at least give our listeners some sort of sense of empowerment, some kind of drive. If you're not already volunteering or getting out there, why not give it a go?
Yeah, you can jump on the Volunteering Canterbury website to do that if you want.